All right, now we're going on in the third of Colossians. We talked about the bond of love, and this love which we were talking about, as you recall, was the love of Christ, which is not a love of feeling and affection so much as a love of caring, although I don't rule out affection or feeling in it. It's a very difficult concept for people to grasp. Of course, we have to ask, what does caring mean? Caring really means a deep concern for another's welfare. I was having a conversation earlier on the subject. What is caring? Having somebody that cares about us is an important thing. We were talking about the possibility of life being complete by our caring for others, but that only lasts to a degree. And the problem with that is that people so often don't respond to our caring, and we think it's all right, but then after a while, if people don't treat us right, you know, or they don't seem grateful, you never can really expect much gratitude from people in general. But still, the point is that the love of Christ for the world, the love of God for the world, is a love whose chief concern is the welfare of the other. And that is a difficult thing for us to come by. We have care for the welfare of some, but we care not so much about the welfare of others. In other words, we may be more inclined to care about the welfare of those outside of us than about the welfare of our family. If we expect so much out of a certain amount out of a person, and we are not given that, then the tendency is to be less concerned about their welfare. Well, at any rate, this is what we're talking about. But the bond of caring is what keeps the body of believers together. They care for each other. Otherwise, it becomes just a doctrinal thing. I've heard a number of Bible teachers whose whole focus is doctrinal teaching. Many that have tapes out and radio broadcasts and so forth, who seem most involved in just didactic or academic teaching. The problem with that is that there's an awful lot of damage that is done in the body through that. It's one thing for a person to be totally uninvolved with others but giving lessons on the Bible versus one who has a parish, one who has a group of people to be concerned about. It makes a lot of difference. It's like the bachelor trying to talk about family life. Maybe one has had pastoral experience, but generally speaking, the only way to keep freshly sensitive to the needs of others is to keep freshly involved in people's needs. And it's easy, it'd be very easy for one, like myself, for example, to just focus on teaching or on writing. It's a lot easier than to be involved with people, but as it is, I've put together a considerable family of people that I'm constantly concerned for. At the present time, I'd say there are about 4 households that I'm responsible for maintaining, sustaining, and caring in a lot, you know, almost in a family sense. And all the interactions of human feelings and emotions there, plus all the sheep, the body of believers everywhere. So one is continually involved. Well, that keeps the message fresh because you've always got to be interacting, and you don't dare have the luxury of not interacting honestly. It's very common for individuals to interact dishonestly because we don't really understand. We don't understand ourselves and don't understand others. And it's easy for people to interact spitefully or petulantly, that is, in or as a martyr. For example, there's the common attitude, well, if that's the way you're going to be, I'm not going to bother with you. Or if that's the way they're going to treat me, yeah, I'm not going to do anything for them. It's a common attitude with parents. Well, if you're going to be that way and you're not going to be grateful, I'm not going to do anything for you. It's a common attitude in human relationships. Well, a lot of those attitudes are false. They sound good. but they're false. A lot of attitudes are spiteful. A lot of attitudes are jealous, envious, a lot of things. And the believer who is trying to put their head together to do what is right and what Christ wants does not have the luxury of a false notion of what is real in a situation. And I've often had it with young people. Often, I've had to say, many human relationships then are off base because of a false reaction, an unsound reaction. Thus, I was saying, for example, that with young people, one says, well, if they're not going to be grateful, then I'm not going to do anything more for them, you see. Or if that's your attitude toward me, then this is going to be my attitude toward you. It's a wrong approach because, as I've given a very cardinal point, a very important point in terms of human relationships, and incidentally, that my experience with human relationships has been a long one and with a great deal of training in professionally in psychology and allied fields of behavioral science. But also, I've been working with people in a direct way for a long time. In fact, even when I was in college, I was in leadership considerably. So that I was in who's who in American colleges and universities for leadership in a college field. See, so that was back in the 40s. Very close, direct experience in working with people. And one of the important principles that I've learned is that you don't let somebody else control who you are. See, if another person is ungrateful or unkind, and you react to that by being yourself unkind or petty or ungrateful or whatever, you see, they're controlling their life, and you learn not to do that. But do what you believe is right or wise or kind or whatever, and do that apart from whether they react properly or not. That'll help you keep your own head straight. And also, one thing that does is save the possibilities of recovery. In a human relationship, for example, if somebody has said something unkind, for example, and we have tended then to back off from them, then that's where the cycle begins, because as we back off from them, they back off from us. It just becomes a downward spiral. But if always we keep openness there, so that there's some realization on their part that even though it's not been something we have appreciated yet, there is the possibility that we could get together and talk again or open up the situation again. But this happens with parents and young people commonly, because the young people are not as experienced in relationships and they don't know quite how to take things. Parents get a sullen attitude from a young person, for example, whereas the parent, the adult, ought to be able to handle a moody person somewhat, as a parent can handle a moody child. They tend to respond to the mood of the young person in kind. Thus, for example, a mother who finds the child pouting or petulant or irritable or whatever is probably going to just go on and do her work anyway. You know, she's not going to stop everything and let that pouting child spoil the day or anything else. She's going to just go on and do whatever she has to do. Now, as you go older, you see, teenagers don't always grow out of that, and adults don't always grow out of it either. But the teenager is a girl, for example, is sullen and pouty because she lost her boyfriend or because of a dozen reasons, including certain physical reasons. And so a feud begins to develop. If she's going to give mom the silent treatment, mom's going to give her the silent treatment. You know, if she's going to be irritable, mom's going to be irritable. And if she's going to go to her room and sit there and not come out, mom is going to be distant from her and so forth. Or with a son. It's more commonly, though, the feuds exist between girls and their mothers, because many reasons for that, but just as a, I know that people might think that I'm being prejudiced to say that, but it's just years of experience that says that the relationship between a mother and a daughter is much more complex and difficult than the relationship between a son and his father, usually. It's a little different situation. But And I've said to many and many a parent, a mother especially, at the time, let's say, of a wedding, on the last week or two before the wedding, it just seems like there's an irritability that emerges. They're both on edge. Of course, it's a normal time of nervousness and everything, but somehow mother and daughter seem to be at each other's throats so much that by the time the wedding comes, the daughter vows never to see her again. You know, it's unfortunate, because whereas the mother should at that time try to leave such an impression with the girl that she wants to come back home, it tends to go the other way. And they're fighting and feuding and scrapping in the last week of their relationship together, and it's a tragic thing. They go out with a feeling of indifference about ever coming back. It's sad. What I'm looking at is unsound relationships between Christian people reflect the fact that we haven't taken seriously how important it is to reach out to other people, how important it is to try to maintain real honesty about the relationship rather than our own phony opinions about it. And we just do not have the luxury to indulge ourselves in unsound attitudes toward others as Christians. It's easy to be a martyr, but if we stop and say, wait a minute, I shouldn't be a martyr. It feels comfortable to me to be a martyr, but it's wrong. Or we should say, I shouldn't be spiteful. It feels comfortable to be spiteful, but it's all it does is breed trouble. Now, many a parent has destroyed their young people by pushing too hard at the wrong time. For example, this famous Manson situation is a perfect example. One of these girls that was a Manson girl who participated in the brutal murder of these people lost her way at a crucial moment when her father ordered her out of the house. She and her father, she had a very good middle-class home, so it was not a ghetto condition or a poverty condition, but just a standard middle-class home. And the girl and the father had a fight. And the father said, well, if that's the way you feel, leave. Get out. I've heard it over and over again. It isn't an unusual thing for parents who are grossly disappointed in a young person to say, well, I don't want any more to do with you. And the girl comes home and maybe she's gotten pregnant or something. Whatever, I've heard it over and over again. Well, if you're going to do that, you don't need to come back to my house. I don't want you under my roof. So, well, anyway, this girl and her father had a fight. She went out, was sitting on a bench out on the strand there, when Charles Manson came along. Now, she didn't know where to go. He offered her something, you know, just, well, since you can't go anywhere else, come with me. He was an engaging person. Of course, everybody agreed to that he was almost charismatic in his ability to draw people after him, almost hypnotic in power. And he got to her. And it was the beginning of the end. It wasn't that girl would never in the world have gone out of her home that night and butchered some people. Never, never. But by the time Manson got through with her, she was easily a butcher. Because drugs got into the picture. Of course, that was a big thing, that once the hypnotic power or the charismatic power of Charles Manson got to her and she was easily persuaded to go into the drugs and the whole scene, and then that was the end. You see, the father may have felt justified. He said, well, this girl has hurt my feelings once too often, or she's defied me once too often, and all of this sort of thing. Parents have had fights with their children, mothers with their daughters, fathers with their daughters, over things that don't really amount to a hill of beans. Why did you take my costume jewelry and wear it to school today? Or, you know, why would you do this or this? Okay, sure, it wasn't a good thing to do. But lesser things than that have destroyed young people. This constant fight over mine and yours, what's mine? And the young person seems to be unable to, let's say, be selfless. The young person is selfish, petulant, a lot of different things, and the parents get exasperated, and all of that's understandable. But the thing you're weighing is, you're weighing in the balance is a soul. And one of the things that I've been very concerned about with my own young people and those I work with, keep the channel open. Keep the channel open between them and Christ. If there's a spark of care about Christ in a young person, don't slam it shut by the age-old dictum, if you're a Christian, you couldn't be doing what you're doing. You know, how can you be a Christian? How can you say you're a Christian and you talk back to your mother? You know, that sort of thing, which happens over and over again. How can you say you're a Christian and treat us like that? How can you say you're a Christian and stay out too late? You know, all that sort of thing. And they de-Christianize them. So it isn't long before the young person says, well, yes, you're right, you know, and that's it. Goodbye. When you're working with people, you learn one thing. Not to push them over the edge. Your young people or others. And parents will push and push and push, and all of a sudden the kid splits, and that's it. Sure, they may have had justification for being unhappy and so forth. Same with husbands and wives. Their situation exists, and they push and push and push. Finally, just push them over the brink. All of it comes down to this point. The love of Christ is the bond that holds believers together. Now, the love of Christ means caring for one another. And I am saying to you that the believers need to be honest in their relationship to one another, to care enough about what happens to the other person, to be careful not to spoil things by an unsound attitude. Leave the door open. But that requires a certain degree of A, selflessness, and B, simply the willingness to be honest. There are lots of leverage things that people use against each other. Thus, for example, the young woman that says to her husband, you don't love me anymore. Why? Well, because he won't take care of getting something that she wants, or a lot of different things that this comes up over. And it may be a tempting thing to say, but it's probably not honest. Or, as I said, the silent treatment. Another one of these common things is, if you don't know, I'm not going to tell you, you know. Sure, the husband says, what's wrong? Well, if you don't know, I'm not going to tell you. You're going to know, you ought to know, you know. Well, maybe you ought to, maybe not. But at any rate, it's an unsound attitude. It breeds trouble. It's not adult. The adult thing is to say, well, let me sit down. I'll tell you now, if the woman's already told him two or three times and he still doesn't get the picture, then she may be justified and say, well, we've already told you many times, you won't listen. That's quite possible. But generally speaking, these human attitudes of petulance or pettiness or martyrdom or envy or whatever they are lead to destruction. I say to you, many a young person's been driven out of their home by attitudes like this on the part of parents, on the part of brothers and sisters. One of the common things is competition between brothers and sisters, which has driven them out of the home. The sisters fighting over everything, clothes, boyfriends, music, everything. Fighting. Told one young woman recently that she has a younger sister, and I said, you know, and they were always fighting, and, you know, there was a question of rights and privileges. So I said, look, the girl's soul is worth more than your rights. You're never going to be a help to her if you keep jumping on her and shouting at her and everything else. How are you going to help her? And it was over dumb things, you know, makeup or clothes or something like that. Well, what difference does that make? This girl could have driven her sister to the devil just for her own selfish desire to have her own way. Sure, she may have rights. Of course, we have a way of feeling that what we think are, what are rights to us, our rights are another person's selfishness. Whether it's rights or selfishness depends on whether it's your situation or theirs. But you see, that's a common thing. Now, the bond of love is what holds believers together, but if we sense the real meaning of the caring of Christ, then we're going to look at others in terms not of what are they giving to us, but what can we give to them. And maybe our love extended to them will bring about in them the caring that they ought to have. We maybe should give them an example of caring. This is, again, repetitious, perhaps, but it's so deeply important. And I wanted to pick up the meaning here. Above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of consummation or fulfillment. Let the peace of Christ then be the judge in your hearts. That is, the one who, it's the peace of Christ that becomes the criterion. Paul says, as much as lies in you, live peaceably with all men. With all people, I should say. Above, as much as lies in you, be at peace with all people. As much as lies in you. Now, you can't always be at peace with people. There's some people that won't let you be at peace with them. But you can't help that. So we come back again to the thing I've said before. You don't react, you act. Do what you think God wants you to do and let him take care of the other fellow. Don't judge your actions on the basis, don't make your decisions on the basis of somebody else's actions. And be thankful, he says. And that's another issue. To be thankful to God for our lot. Someone has said, years and years ago I heard this, never forgot it. If we could make one heap of all the troubles in the world, everybody puts their trouble on the heap, and then we are given the choice to go and pick up whatever troubles we prefer to have, we'd probably go and pick up our own and take it back again. Whatever problems you think you have, somebody else has one worse. And then what you look at people and say, oh, well, we make our judgments on the basis of what we think people are or what we think their life is like. And you look at that ideal couple and you say, well, if only we were like they are. But if you could get inside of them, they're probably saying, boy, if I could only be like you are. No, but we judge on the surface all the time, continually. You look at people and say, I wish I could be spiritual like that. You don't know how spiritual a person is. Or I wish I could be stable or strong. You don't know how strong that person is or how stable. There's no way we can tell what that other person is really like. So it's better not to compare. There's no way that we can determine somebody else's trouble. And we look at them and think they have an ideal life and there are no problems. But there may be a peck of troubles under the surface that we don't know anything about. And we say, well, how come God lets them have such a nice life and he gives me such a rotten one? You don't know how nice that life is. To be thankful to God for what we have, our present situation, because this is something that he allows us to have. He could change it all in a minute. So to be thankful means to accept the lot that we have and be appreciative that we have this kind of lot, and we are not, it isn't misfitted to us, that we don't have to have the lot of some people. It's just a matter of being grateful for what we've got, but it's just human nature over and over and over again to be so worried about what we don't have that we don't stop to think about what we do have. So he says, be ye thankful. And then he makes this statement, and we'll probably conclude with this. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to God. And whatever you do, all things that you do, in word or in work, do all in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, giving thanks to God and the Father through him. Now, I'm going to just leave you with this thought that there's only one way to evaluate and look at our lives. Only one. That is, in the name of Christ. It has nothing to do with what the rest of the world thinks, what the sociologists think, what the psychologists think, what the women liberals think, what the men male chauvinists think. It doesn't make any difference, none of it. What does Christ think? In our human relationships with others, it doesn't make any difference whether it isn't a question of being spiteful or martyr-like or whatever. It's how would Christ have us react? not what rights do we have to respond in human animosity, but what privilege do we have to respond in the love of Christ? So we don't act in terms of what the other person does, otherwise we let them control our lives. And a lot of people have become what the other person has made them, in the sense that the other person may be selfish or petty or whatever, but if we allow ourselves to become selfish or petty in response to that, then they have taken something from us. In the past years, I've done a lot of teaching. Sometimes students have taken advantage because of the effort to bend over backward to give a break. In other words, for example, if someone, let's say they're late with a paper, and they come to me with a reason why they're late, I'm more likely to give them the benefit of the doubt and to give them a chance to make it up than I am to be skeptical. Now, the point is this. If they're deceiving me and being false about it, they haven't taken anything from me. I've responded in generosity. I've added something to my character. They have taken something from their character because they've been dishonest. I've been charitable, they've been dishonest. I gain, they lose. Now, if I let them rob me also of my charitableness or generosity, then they have hit me on two counts. They've not only deceived me, but they've also robbed me of my character. I don't mean we can be naive, but if we respond to another in the way they act toward us, we allow them to rob us of something of our character. The point of all of this is, if you evaluate people and function with people in the name of Christ, you'll avoid that, because you'll do what you think the Spirit wants you to do in their behalf. You lead the way in kindness. As I said to this young lady who was giving her sister difficulty. His sister was a very young teen, and the girl was in her 20s, you know, and I said, you see, you ought to be an example to the girl of kindness, generosity, and so forth, rather than reacting in terms of your own rights. Shame on her for jeopardizing the soul of her sister for the sake of her own selfish interests. And shame on anyone, shame on us for the same thing, for jeopardizing another for the sake of our own selfish interests. Well, let's pray.